File 5.
Chapter 5. Now, when Siddhartha returned to the garden house, one ran before him and told the women what had occurred, and the ladies bore the news to the princess where she was waiting. And when she heard it, she said, "Oh, ill-foreboding heart of mine! Did I not know that the anger of the gods must burn against those who would conceal their righteous doom from any man born upon this cruel earth? For who can fight with fate? If this drives my lord to despair, what shall be done?" So she sent messages to the Maharaja, telling him the danger, and went forth to the painted hall to seek the prince. And she sat there, alone, surrounded by lovely images painted upon the walls, where joy and triumph and love clasped hands, and dancing limbs shone amongst flowers, and all the world was white with spring. Now, something in his eyes held his wife from him, and she had no courage to draw near, and went and sat herself humbly on the ground before him, but at a distance. And at last he said, "This was the secret. You knew it and did not tell me." And in the hall was no sound. "You saw me fed with lies such as these." And he flung out his arms against the pictures. "And you did not tell me they were the mask of horror." She bowed her head upon her hands, speechless. "And I, most pitiable, most ignorant, rejoiced that a son should be given to me, not knowing that such a one is born to a heritage of wretchedness and the inevitable approach of shame and ruin. And from this is no escape, for the gods have appointed no end to our misery, no doors from the prison, but we must live eternally and horribly, old and disgraced in body and mind. Could a man but end it and fall into the dark and to be forgotten? Oh, had I known, no child of mine should ever have felt the whip and drag to the chain. I will not blame you, who are but a woman. But my father, my father." And in the hall was no sound at all. And the princess, hiding her face, thought, "Shall I tell him of the end? Of death?" But she dared not. And he called aloud to the women and said, "Deface these pictures, for they are lies, and the sight of them turns the knife in the wound. Blot them out with blackness." So it was done. But the Maharaja, in terror, bade them redouble the pleasures of paradise and of the garden house. And at great cost, he brought a fair slave from the outlands, golden-haired as dawn, sapphire-eyed as the blue ice of the Himalaya, white as the elephant's tusk, skilled in all arts of love. And among the darker beauties of the pleasure chambers, she moved radiant, as though day had broken forth in starry midnight. And all the neighbouring kings heard and were envious. And in all this beauty, all hoped, even the sad Yashodhara. And her heart failed her when she saw the prince's eyes coldly averted from loveliness that might have stirred the eternal gods,
And again she sent a message to the Maharaja.
Your son, my lord, will not look upon the beautiful white stranger, nor any. Oh, send him forth in freedom. For penned in these sweet gardens, he muses and meditates. And what is in his heart, I cannot know, but fear very terribly. Yet guard the way, that no sad sight approach him, for if he sees more, all is lost.
And again orders were given, and as before the prince set forth, but this time grave and sad, and the crowd said his mood, and the city could not rejoice. And as they neared the street, all aflutter with banners and flowers and perfumes, and thronged with silent, gazing thousands, again, a divinity masked his divinity in tortured flesh. Thus it is told, and by the way was seen a sick man struggling for life in a losing battle. His body was swollen and disfigured. His hollow cheeks blazed with fever, and in his dying eyes fear and agony contended. Scarce could he drag himself along, moaning and crying for pity, the hot tears pouring and searing his cheeks as they ran. And seeing it, the prince set his hands on the rein and checked the horses, and cried aloud, "What is this horror?" So the charioteer, Channa, with fear tearing at his vitals, yet compelled by a force beyond all resistance to know other than the truth, answered, "Prince, it is a sick man. The four elements are all confused and disordered. He is worn, feeble, and strengthless, tortured in body and mind, dependent upon the mercy of men, whose own evil day is but postponed." And a shudder ran through the crowd as the prince questioned him, shrinking back as one in mortal fear.
"And this, too, is the common doom?
Prince, none escape it.
And the few poor years that old age leaves us are broken into misery like this?"
"Prince, it is so." And he said,
"Turn my chariot again. I will go no further. I have seen what I have seen."
So the news was carried to the Maharaja, and he was almost beside himself, raging with anger that was half fear. And he sent for his wise minister and cried to him,
"What shall we do? For my son is learning the guarded secrets, and if I keep him shut in the gardens, he will rebel and break away. And if I send him through the city, such devils are my servants that horrible sights afflict him and disperse my hopes in him. Here have I built a paradise so heavenly that could he but see it, I need fear no more. For the man is not born who could leave its deep and delicious shades for the dusty world. And there have I placed a golden maiden, whose smile is sunshine, and her lips singing roses. And were he to see her, but what do I say? Is it not possible to a great person like myself, that for a few short hours the city way should be guarded from horror while he passes through? I am fallen indeed otherwise.
But the old wise minister shook his head.
Great sir, one should say it is possible. Yet, when I remember how the city was searched and guarded this twice, what dare I say? Oh, Maharaja, may it not be that the high gods, being resolved, may not be thwarted, and that we fight against iron destiny. Great fear possesses me. But his master replied angrily, Foolish old man, and was not I given the choice? If I could withhold the truth, he would be a great world king. If he guessed it, he would be an ascetic of the jungle. What father would choose other than I have done? Once more, I will send him to my paradise. And if this time I am tricked, let your head answer it.
And again, the prince was sent out. But this time also, though the city was decorated and garlanded, there was no semblance of joy. And the very horses went with drooped heads, as though fear were the charioteer. And as they reached the seat where most of the people crowded, the divinity was again ready with his work, having prepared a sight terrible and woeful. For slowly preceding the chariot, there went a funeral train, with four men bearing a bier, and lying on it a body cold and stiff, with drooping jaw and dreadful dead eyes staring blindly at the sun. Withered flowers lay on the bier, and the mourners beat their breasts and wept aloud, filling the air with wailing and lamentation. And the prince, closing his eyes to shut out the horror and clenching his palms, said, What is this? And Channa, not daring to look in his face, answered very low, bowed under the weight of words he was compelled to utter. That is a dead man, all his powers of body destroyed, life departed, his heart without thought, his intellect dispersed, his spirit is fled, his body withered, stretched out like a dead log, taken from all who loved him, and mourning, they carry him forth to burn and obliterate him, for they, even they, will have no more of his presence, now become loathsome, but cast him from them utterly. And this is death. And into his clenched hands he murmured, Is this also the common lot? And the charioteer replied with hidden face, Prince, it is so. He who begins his life must end it. And thus, for death may at any moment seize us and carry us away into darkness. Then Siddhartha sank down in the chariot, his soul warring with his body, catching at the leaning board for support, hiding his face from the light of day as the dead man was borne on before him, and wailing and lamentation filled the air. And into his clenched hands he murmured, Oh, terrible delusion of mortal men, who, born in pain and utterly deluded, are brought through grief and sickness and old age to this frightful end. Disperse the people. Turn back my chariot. The whole world is a lie. I have seen what I have seen. So the people melted silently away in tears, as clouds disperse in rain. For seeing the prince's horror and amazement in learning the truth for the first time, they also sounded the deeps of their own misery, and life appeared to them a traitor, and in all the universe was no comfort. But Channa, the charioteer, not daring to return because of the Maharaja's strict command, drove onward to the paradise. And the prince, crouching in the silks and gold with face hidden, neither knew nor cared. So at last they came in among the green lawns and pleasant waters and deep-leaved trees, the last hope of the Maharaja. And slowly and painfully he dismounted. Suddenly, about the chariot, running and fluttering like doves, came the lovely ones provided for pleasure, beautiful as flowers in a paradise of gods, adorned with chains of pearls and other jewels. Beautiful were they, each one chosen as merchants choose a pearl to complete a queen's necklace, for their eyes were long and languishing, half hidden in black lashes as stars in midnight, and their mouths pomegranate buds, disclosing seeds of ivory, and down to the ankle rolled their lengths of perfumed hair. Most beautiful is the bosom of a woman, for in its gentle curves are all love, all tenderness expressed, and these displayed its loveliness, dear as rare jasmine flowers, precious as sweet food to the hungry, unveiled, or veiled as little in transparency, like the running of shallow water. And thus they surrounded him as he passed through the blossomed trees, wrapped in sorrowful meditation, pale with the terror of gazing for the first time on the face of death. So they fluttered about him, the lovely ones, skilled in all subtleties of love, shedding enticements as the moon distills dew of camphor. One, seeing him sad, saddened her sweet face and looked at him with tears hanging on long lashes, as though she would say, "Dear prince, I too have tasted grief. Do I not know?" And one, smiles chasing one another to cover her merry eyes, promised forgetfulness, gladness in her arms, and some, clinging together like sister roses on twined stems, seemed to defy severance, even if love should call them, tempting him who watched them to essay that sweet sorrow. But amidst them the prince paced, lost in grief, not seeing them, or seeing, heeding not at all. And presently, when they had tried all their arts and could draw his regards no more than remote stars can draw the gaze of a cold moon, they fell silent and gathered fearfully into groups, drawing back. Now there stood in the shade of the bamboos a man, much about the person of the Maharaja, sent to see if all were well. And when the prince passed on, careless, this nobleman, Udei, came out and addressed the silent beauties.
"You women, all so graceful and fair, are you thus worsted? Surely in all ages men have been subject to women when they put forth their power. Too soon are you discouraged, too soon. For this prince, though he restrains his heart with the bit and bridle of purity, is but a man, and the wisest and the greatest in time past have slipped where they thought themselves secure. And there is no fetter strong as white arms about a man's neck. Strive after new devices. Redouble your efforts. Great is the prize."
And the maidens, ashamed and angry at his chiding, fluttered again about the prince, where he sat in the shade of a jumbo tree, putting forth amorous incitements, forgetful of all modesty and womanly reserve, pressing on, striving to move him. But he, in his great heart, sorrowful, apart, looked upon them, sighing.
"Oh, creatures, most miserable, unheeding the dooms of age and death, forgetful of the briefness of beauty, unconscious that above your throats is suspended the sharp, two-edged sword, how wretched is your empty playing in the very jaws of destruction!"
And though he spoke nothing, they saw the homeless horror in his eyes, and again they shrank away, afraid. So, seeing the prince alone, Udei, smooth of speech, came softly along the pleasure paths of the paradise, brushing aside the flowers, observant and quiet as a serpent. And saluting the prince, he drew up beside him and spoke thus:
"Prince, in whom all beauty and nobility meet, you sit here sad and alone. And it is therefore that your great father, consumed by care for your welfare, appointed me to act as beseems a friend. Permit me then to seek, for a wise friend removes what is unprofitable, promotes real gain, and, in adversity, is true."
And Siddharth, lifting his eyes, said,
"Speak, if indeed in this great strait there be anything to say."
So, supporting his arm on a bough of the fire-flame tree, Udei spoke, inclining his dark face and subtle eyes towards the prince.
"True it is that sickness may assail us, and that old age and death will by no means be balked of their prey. Yet youth is youth, and beauty divine, and the man who turns his back on pleasure because it passes is a coward. Indeed, the rose is the sweeter, because even in blooming it treads the way of death, and soon we shall see it no more. Truly, my prince, you are afflicted with a distempered mind. Acquiescence is the secret of life. We who are wise know that these things must be, and even old age and death, the conquerors, we take to enhance our pleasures, saying to ourselves, 'The moment is mine, and love is sweet, and lust the spur of life. This moment neither death nor old age can take from me. I will spend it as a man would spend his all if he knew that next
day he would be plundered and a beggar. But Siddharth was silent, with brooding eyes fixed on the ground. And presently, Udai resumed in a delicately modulated voice. While you believe that joy and beauty were eternal, and that ages hence these women would still surround you, beautiful and yielding, then you might well shrink from a delight too prolonged, for dropped honey cloys. An eternity of love may well become hell. Was it not so, my prince? And slowly the prince answered, it was so. I have looked on the racing river, swollen with melting snows, thinking that, were any end possible, to be hurled, beaten and broken down the rocks in its mad hurry, that were better than the changeless paradise of love and soft words and swooning music. There you are right, Uday, the smooth-tongued. This is true. And highly satisfied, Uday resumed. And now, having learnt that there is an end, what should be your course? The pleasures of a prisoner released, who enjoys knowing that he has a respite, though the doors will shut upon him one day. Surely, it is not the part of a brave man to fling away what he has, because he cannot have it all, nor to own himself conquered, because one day he must face the enemy whom, as yet, he has not seen. No, not so. Take what the gods send. The gods who have themselves been amenable to beauty and docile in the arms of loveliness. Indeed, what choice is there but to slink through life, starting at every shadow, or to dice and drink and love like a man tasting the best while it lasts? For what comes after, we cannot tell. Who knows? And the prince said, this has the sound of wisdom, yet wisdom it is not. There is an answer. There is a way, but I have found not it. It may be that it cannot be found, that there is no such thing. Yet, better the search than dully to agree with necessity. And as for these women, to me they are no enticement. And if I would, I cannot. Under their fair faces I see the skull, and they mop and mow like apes in the face of horror. If the gods have thus made the world, it is a folly and a brutality, and they are more foolish than men who must abide their cruelties. And if they have not made it, and all is chance, we sink in the slough, lit only by the flicker of dying dreams. Leave me, Uday, the smooth-tongued. I would be alone. And the courtier crept silently away under the green shades, treading lightly on turf and blossoms, thanking destiny that he was not as Sybaris, but could lift the brimming cup and drain it to the dregs, savouring every sparkle. And in his heart he mocked him, laughing at his weakness. He, whose name is now remembered only because one day he spread out his folly before the perfect one. But the prince, bending his great brows upon life and death, sat beneath the jumbo tree, feet folded, hands laid upon his knees, in perfect immobility. And he thought,
hollow compliance and a protesting heart, is this life? Is there a better? Great are the concerns of life and death, so great, so awful, that the poor race of mankind struggles only to forget for a brief moment what it can never comprehend. For all about us are seen injustices that were a king to commit, his miserable people would rise and hurl him from his bloody throne. And we are told by the priests that the gods have committed these crimes, and yet are worthy of worship and honour. No. Rather is it the propitiation of fiends who will torture us if they have not the civility of our praises, while we die for their pleasure, and the good suffer, and the evil flourish, and to the rich man is given more riches, and to the poor man more toil, even exceeding their strength. Now, indeed, all that was hidden from me bursts upon my mind, as when a flash of lightning tears the dark, and things I put aside for want of comprehension shriek aloud in my ears. Why am I clothed in jewels? Why is my father generous and good, and my wife the fairest and most loving of women, when, at this moment, were my eyes opened, they would behold men dying for bread, that the least of my jewels would buy, with none to tend or pity them? And why are my deserts more than theirs? And why are some evil and some good, as it were, by nature? Oh, cruel gods, who, lapped in far-off pleasures, care nothing for our agonies, and let fall your good things on the wicked and evil things on the good. Yourselves, perhaps, the sport of chance, if indeed you are at all. And these thoughts, and many like them, black and miserable, stormed about him in the wreckage of the world. And at long last he aroused himself, and the paradise was empty of all but a broad moonlight that lay in glories of light and shadow on trees and waters. And there was deep silence, for the women, ashamed and terrified, had slipped noiselessly away, and so back to the city. And far off down a long glade, his chariot and wearied horses stood waiting in marble patience. And Channa sat beside them, his head bowed upon his raised knees, like an embodied grief. Very slowly, the horses paced through the city, and that also was empty of all but moonlight, for not a living soul went or came in the quiet, and the pacing of the horses echoed loudly down the empty ways. And not a word was spoken as they went, but when they reached the house of the garden, a woman ran out to meet them, veiled like a ghost in the moonlight, and cried aloud, "Oh, happy prince, and happiest! The gods are good to this glad house and to you, for on the bosom of the princess lies your first-born son." And at these words,
A strange trembling seized him, so that for a moment he hid his face in his hands. Then, pale in the moonlight, he said these words.
A fetter is set upon me. Therefore, call the child Rahula. A fetter.